All right. Well, Daniel chapter 8, we're talking about the ram and the goat. And Joseph was back there trying to figure out if this was last week's or this week's. And he said, no, I would have remembered if we were talking about a goat. So this week, we were talking about goats. Joseph's favorite. All right. Last week, there was a bit of a transition that we saw in the text in the book of Daniel, transitioning from primarily narrative, talking about, you know, when Daniel refused the king's diet and Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, they were in the furnace, and then Daniel and the lions, and that those are all like narrative stories. We're transitioning out of that and have transitioned into primarily prophecy, going from chapter 7 forward. We're looking at a lot of prophecy, and we actually looked at the first of Daniel's four visions or dreams last week, and looking at the vision of the four beasts. And we should also remember that in recounting this dream and its interpretation, Daniel was going back in time. He went back some 14 years in time from chapter 6, where he was talking about being in the lion's den. And so he went back to 553 BC, which was the first year of Darius. And chapter 7 wrapped up this chunk of Daniel that is focusing on the time of the Gentiles, on God's plan for the nations outside of Israel. And so we looked at a few comparisons in between chapter 2 and chapter 7. They have a lot to do with each other. And that whole section, as you'll see and be reminded of on that timeline, or that outline rather, was written in Aramaic. And now that we're jumping into chapter 8, Daniel's focus is shifting back to Israel, and the language that he's writing in is shifting as well back to Hebrew. He was writing in Aramaic because he was writing to the Chaldeans. He wanted to write to them in a language that they could understand, that would resonate with them. And it's reasonable to surmise that Daniel now at this point is wondering, there are still these three other Gentile empires, these three other Gentile nations that are to come on the scene. When he's writing this, he was writing still during the Babylonian Empire, during the Babylonian captivity. And so it's natural for him to wonder, okay, what's going to happen with Israel now? Where are God's chosen people going to go, and what does God have for them? And he spends the last chunk of chapters really addressing Israel and shedding some light on that. And so, as I mentioned, we were looking at some parallelism last week between chapter 2 and chapter 7. What were some of the similarities that we saw between those two chapters? You guys recall?
What was chapter 2?
Chapter 2, that's Nebuchadnezzar's statue dream.
Yeah, all the different metals.
Uh-huh.
In correlation with kingdoms geographically.
Yeah.
Babylonia and Medo-Persia and...
Good.
Greece.
Yeah. All right, let me throw up that image that we had last week. Hopefully you can see that well, and that can spark our memories a little bit and remind us that we're dealing with these same nations that you mentioned, with Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And the four beasts that we saw in chapter 7 correspond with the same statue that represents those beasts, or represents those nations from chapter 2. And so, yeah, Babylon is represented by the gold head and by the lion with the eagle's wings, Medo-Persia by the silver chest and arms, and also by the bear that's kind of lopsided. Greece is represented by the bronze stomach and thighs, and by the leopard. Remember, we talked about the leopard being quick. He's got the four wings on his back, and he's speedy. And we'll talk a lot more about Medo-Persia and Greece today. And then Rome is represented by the iron, and then later on the iron and the clay in chapter 2. And then by this dreadful and terrifying beast is how he's described in Daniel. Daniel doesn't assign an animal identity to the fourth beast. He just says that he was dreadful and terrifying. He had 10 horns, and he had one horn come up out of those 10 horns and displace three of them. But we did look at Revelation 13, 1 and 2, and there we see that that beast that comes up also has 10 horns and has blasphemous names written on its head, just like this little horn from Daniel chapter 7. And in Revelation, John says that he saw this beast like a leopard, and its feet were like those of a bear, and its mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon, or Satan, gave him his power and his throne and his great authority. And so we talk about how Rome seems to be kind of an amalgamation of the other empires that preceded it, and just took and borrowed parts of its culture and certainly parts of its geography. All right. As we look into Daniel's second dream in Daniel chapter 8, I guess we should ask if there are any thoughts or questions from last week or chapter 7, because that is a heavy chapter. Is everybody trekking so far up to this point? All right, good. Well, we'll get into a little bit more detail, as I mentioned, particularly with the second and third kingdoms, with Medo-Persia and Greece today. And I want to read through the entirety of the chapter before we get started. So can I get four volunteers to take those four passages and help us just read through it before we jump in? Verse 1 through 8, 9 through 14, 15 through 19, and 20 through 27. Andy, you want to grab the first one? Sam, you got 9 through 14. Joseph, 15 through 19, and then 20 through 27. Greg, thank you. Go ahead, Andy.
In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns for the four winds of heaven.
Sam?
Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars, it threw down to the ground and trampled them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the great burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And the host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" He said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state."
When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man, and I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation. For it pertains to the appointed time of the end.
As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, if not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have breached their limit, a king of boldface, one who understands riddles, shall arise. By his power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without having warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that had been told is true. The seal of the vision for it refers to many days from now. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it.
All right. That's a lot. And remember what Greg just read in that last verse, that Daniel, after this, he was perplexed. After getting the interpretation from an angel, he said, dude, I don't get it. I don't understand it. And he was sick, and he got up and went to work. So if we're not getting it just yet, that's okay. Hang in there, and we'll keep plugging away, and hopefully we will make some progress. So a couple of things that I think we would do well to point out right off the bat is that in 8:20, it identifies the ram as Medo-Persia, and 8:21, it clearly identifies the goat as Greece. And so that's going to be helpful to know beforehand as we're walking through this. So keep that in mind. Another important note is that the little horn here in chapter 8 is not the same as the little horn that we talked about in chapter 7. Though those were talking about two different beasts, talking about two different beasts that represent two different nations, two different little horns. So keep that in mind also as we walk through this. And now let's add to the diagram that we just had up there, the one that I took out of my K. Arthur book. And we'll see, again, just adding the ram on there, also representing Medo-Persia, and the goat, also representing Greece. And so the ram is also represented by the bear in chapter 7. Those are two different animals representing the same nation. And then the goat and the leopard, again, both representing Greece. That hopefully will help us going forward. All right, well, let's go back to the beginning of the chapter and take note of the location where this is taking place, the time and the location. So again, this is the second dream now that Daniel's had. The first dream was in chapter 7 with the four beasts. This is the second dream, separated by about 2 years. Daniel is very precise and meticulous in his dating. So back in 7:1, he said that it was the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, when he saw his first vision. Now here in 8:1, he says, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, he sees this vision. And so now this is 551 when he's seeing this second vision. And in verse 2, it says, well, actually, the end of verse 1, it says that it was subsequent to the first one, which appeared to me previously, talking about the four beasts. Verse 2, I looked in the vision, and I was looking, as I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. And so Daniel wasn't physically there, right? He was just, that's where he was in his dream. A couple weeks ago, I had a dream that I was in my childhood house, right? I wasn't actually there. That's just for some reason where my mind took me. And this is where his dream is taking place. And so I want to pull up a map and show us this map. This is a map of the Babylonian Empire. And right there toward the center, where we have this red star, that's where Babylon is at. If you look to the left of that, where we have this green star, that is where Jerusalem is at. And the distance between Babylon and Jerusalem is about 500 miles, and that's as the crow flies if they were to actually walk that, which they did, right? Being taken into captivity a few times, they would have to walk about double that distance. Well, to the right of Babylon, over toward the end of the map on the right side, where that yellow star now is, that's where Susa is. And it's about 230 miles between Babylon and Susa. And Susa would later become the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so that's where this dream is taking place, over in Susa, the soon-to-be capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so he continues on in this dream that he's having from this location. Again, not physically, but in his dream. It says in verse 3, I lifted up my eyes and I looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns, was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone who could rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased, and he magnified himself. And so we have two horns, one larger and coming up later than the first. And remind me again, who or what empire does the ram represent?
Medo-Persian.
All right, good. We need to get that concreted into our minds so that we don't forget. So this Medo-Persian Empire comprised these two separate but allied nations, the Medes and the Persians. And as mentioned last week, when we were looking at the bear, which is kind of up on one side, the Persian Empire was more powerful, more influential, stronger than the Media Empire. They also rose up after the Median Empire, just like the horns. There are two horns, they're both tall, but one's taller, and one rose up later than the other. So that would be representative of the Persian Empire, which overpowered and to a degree overshadowed the Medes. And so the Persians rose up after the Medes, but were more powerful and influential in their alliance, just like this horn. What else do we learn about the ram figure in these verses? What's your Bible say there in Daniel 8:4? What are some things we learn about the ram?
Charged westward and northward and southward, no beast could stand before him.
Good. So he charged or butted to the west, to the north, and to the south. No other beast could withstand his power, so he was not just powerful, but dominant in his power, right? Nobody else could even come close. And what else? All right. He did his own thing, right? He magnified himself, is how the NASB put it. He was very proud of himself, very boastful, not dissimilar from the little horn that we saw in chapter 7, but not representing the same nation or individual. I want to go back and look at this aspect, the ram butting to the west and the north and the south. Remember the ram representing the Medes and the Persians, right? So let me pull back up this map of the Babylonian Empire, and I'm going to show you a map of the Medo-Persian Empire. So pay attention to the boundaries of where the Babylonians conquered and how far they went. And we'll see that the Medes and the Persians, they indeed did but to the west and the north and the south. You see that they go over even into Lydia and Thrace, and they took all that land captive. They butted down to the, or up into the north, up into the area of Asia, and then down into the south, they went and conquered all of Egypt, which Babylon previously had not done, at least not to that same extent and degree that the Medes and the Persians did. In 2 Chronicles, toward the end of 2 Chronicles, it might even be the very last verse of 2 Chronicles, in 36:23, it says, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth." And so they conquered quite a bit, right? Wherever he wanted to go, he went, and he had power, he had dominion. No one else could withstand his power, as the text says, and he magnified himself. And then,
so the king here is Cyrus, that's the king of Persia at the time?
In 2 Chronicles 36, yeah.
Well, who's the king in chapter 8 here of Persia?
It's not really focusing in on one king per se, it's focusing in on the reign of their empire. So the ram is not representative of one particular king, but their whole dynasty. All right, so if we continue on in verse 5, it says that while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west. Now, who does a male goat represent? What nation? What empire?
Greece.
Greece, good. And if we look to the west of our map to the left, we see Greece over there on the west, right? And so they're going to come over and begin to dominate. Well, if we keep reading, it says that the male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram and had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. So the goat is rushing at the ram. Greece is rushing at Medo-Persia. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So, do you know of any conspicuous rulers of the Greek Empire?
Alexander the Great.
Yeah. He was quite conspicuous, right? So the conspicuous horn of 8-5 is representative of Alexander the Great, who was very, very conspicuous, right? Notice how unusual the imagery here is, that the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Now, Joseph, how many horns do goats typically have?
It's two.
Two. Are they between their eyes?
No.
Not quite, right? But this goat has one horn, and it comes up between his eyes. Very unusual, very conspicuous. What else is unique about this goat?
He doesn't touch the ground.
Yeah, he's pictured as floating because of the immense speed with which he moved, right? And I put those dates on there, 334 to 330 BC. That's how long it took for Alexander the Great, this conspicuous horn of the goat, to come in and to conquer all the land that he had. Less than 4 years, closer to 3 years, he came in and just dominated the Medo-Persian Empire and even expanded it to include Greece as well. He was only 22 years old when he came in and first began to attack the Medo-Persian Empire. So talk about a conspicuous horn. You have a 22-year-old come in 4 years, lay waste to all that land, that whole empire. That's pretty unusual, right? That's pretty speedy and quick. I told you when we were going through chapter 4 and talking about Nebuchadnezzar and how he's just unkempt, this wild man out there eating grass. Whenever I read that, I think of Robin Williams in Jumanji, right? After he comes up out of that jungle or whatever, he's been in years, 4 years, and he's just unkempt and has wild hair and everything. Well, when I read about this goat that's floating across land, I think of the cheesy CGI from Twilight and how they would just kind of float across, and they're just trying to say, oh, they're running so fast, but it's super cheesy, and they're just kind of floating across the land. That's what I think of when I think of this kind of floating goat. And so if we look in verse 8 again, it says, then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So as soon as he was mighty, right at the peak of his power, Alexander died. And he left his kingdom, as we've talked about before, to his four generals. He had a couple of kids, but they passed away, perhaps intentionally, somebody, you know, off them so they wouldn't be able to take this empire. And he left his mighty empire to four generals. Yes, Joseph.
I just want to make sure I remember right. You said Alexander was the Greece empire?
Yep. Yeah, he is that large, conspicuous horn that's represented on that's on the goat, which represents the Empire of Greece. And then, yeah, he dies, and he leaves it to his four generals. And so the text talks about this large horn being broken, and in its place there comes up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven, toward each direction. And so those four horns are represented by the four generals. Yes? Yeah, and that could be said of each of these previous empires, too. Nebuchadnezzar, he had whatever he wanted. Wherever he wanted to go, he went without anybody putting up a fight. But then the Medes and the Persians, they took and they expanded that even farther. And then, yeah, Alexander the Great came in, and less than 4 years, he took and he expanded that even more to include even Greece. And then Rome's going to do the same thing. They're really going to show somebody how to build an empire and expand it out to an even greater degree. Yes, Andy.
Well, Alexander conquered way further east than the Medes and Persians. He went all the way into India. He was pretty established as a strategic and tactical genius. I mean, he just didn't stop.
Yeah.
The thing that slowed him down was he got an arrow that went up into his armpit and under his armor, and that's when he went back to Babylon and died.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, there are records of him just slumping into a depression because he conquered everything that there was to be conquered, yeah. And that was what drove him.
Well, in the you know, when we're talking about Daniel's time, what is it, 551 B.C., this is 200 and something years before Alexander rises.
Yeah.
It would be like us saying, oh, by the way, El Salvador is going to go north and is going to conquer the United States. Greece was just a little spot.
Yep.
The Medo-Persian Empire was ginormous.
Yeah, it would have been ridiculous at the time, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, good point. All right, well, I want to show you a map of this empire, and first, we'll put up that map again of the Medo-Persian Empire, and then I'll throw up this map of the Greek Empire. You'll see that it has expanded primarily to include Greece over on the left, and I'll read for you, hopefully pretty quickly, these four generals that he leaves his empire to. So Ptolemy took Egypt. You've probably heard of the Ptolemaean Empire. He took Egypt and Cyrene and Palestine and Cyprus and parts of Asia Minor. We see that there in the pink. Seleucus got Syria, Babylonia, southern Asia Minor. You see that in the gray. Lysimachus was given control over Thrace and western Asia Minor in the yellow. And Cassander controlled Greece and Macedonia in the green and the orange. And so before, the text tells us that nobody could escape the ram's power, but now nobody could escape the power of the goat or the influence of the goat. The goat just came along and took all of that control, all of that power and authority that the ram once had, and took it for himself. And I want to read for us from 1 Maccabees, which isn't in the Bible. It's in the Apocrypha. It's not inspired, but it's useful for historical purposes. And it talks about Alexander the Great. And so 1 Maccabees, I'll start in 1:1. This is how the book starts. It says that after Alexander, son of Philip, the Macedonian, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated King Darius, the Persian, and the Medes. That's not the Darius that we've read about. That's Darius III. He comes along later in the Medo-Persian Empire. It says that he succeeded him as king. He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death the kings of the earth. He advanced to the ends of the earth and plundered many nations. When earth became quiet before him, he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries, nations, and princes, and they became tributary to him. And then it goes on to talk about his demise and these four horns that pop up. It says in verse 5, after this, he fell sick and perceived that he was dying. So he summoned his most honored officers who had been brought up from him with him from his youth and divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. So that's how history records this image of the goat, this conspicuous horn and the four horns that come up after him. Any thoughts or questions at this point? Sam. Yeah.
All right, so we've got Ptolemies and Seleucus and Antigonius. So it looks like we got at least five there.
Yeah, that Antigonus, and it has a one there. It's Antigonus the One-Eyed, so apparently he had one eye. And he comes along later. And This was, I've told you before, I'm kind of limited on the maps that I'm able to take and use from Google without putting our church at risk of being sued or whatever. And so I only looked into that a little bit, enough to figure out that Antigonus had one eye. And that, yeah, he I don't know really how he fits into there, but.
So it was divided between four generals. It's just that
yes.
Antigonus guy came later and this was the map that was
available. I believe so. Yep. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts or questions? All right. Well, let's go ahead and look at verse 9. So Daniel 8, and we'll go 9 to 14 again. It says, out of one of them came forth a rather small horn. So first off, what is it talking about when it says out of one of them? Out of one of what came forth a rather small horn? All right, so one of those four small horns that Greece was divided up into. Good. So out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land, which is talking about Israel. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, angels, no doubt, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled. He said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. And so we want to notice first off that this fifth horn grows out of the four horns which sprouted up after the goat's large, mighty horn was broken off. And again, some will try to equate this little horn with the horn of chapter 7. Remember that that horn in chapter 7, it grew up out of or after 10 horns and displaced 3 horns. There are just so many differences that it can't be the same little horn. However, there still are some similarities between this little horn of chapter 8 and the little horn of chapter 7, who we identified as talking about the Antichrist, the little horn of chapter 7. Namely, that they both start off really small, right? And they both acquire for themselves great power. We see that in verse 9, for this little horn anyway, that it started off rather small, and then down to verse 11, it magnified itself to be equal with the commander and began just really causing all kinds of unrest. And again, skipping forward down to verse 27, we should remind ourselves that Daniel had a hard time understanding this, right? Even after being told by an angel. And so we should take that into account as we're trying to understand this and seeking to come to an understanding, come to a consensus, that there should be some room for disagreement here because it's not made absolutely clear. And so, for example, when I read verse 10, talking about it growing up to the host of heaven and causing some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall down out of the earth and trample them down, my mind immediately went to Revelation 12, talking about Satan falling from heaven, taking a third of the stars with him, and Isaiah 14. And then even down, I think it's in verse 24, at the beginning of 24, yeah, it says that his power will be mighty, but not his own power. I didn't really explore that too much, but I think there might be some connection there between what's going on here in these verses 9 through 14 and Satan being influential and constructive in all this, again, with Revelation 12 and Ezekiel 28, Isaiah 14. But there does, however, seem to be a consensus among the main commentaries that I use, men that are much smarter than I am, Reynolds Showers and Dwight Pentecost and John Walvoord and Matthew Henry. They all agree that the host of heaven and that the stars referred to in verses 9, 10, I think, and 11, that they all are referring to the Jewish people. So when we read about the host and the stars, that's in reference to the Jews. And we also see that if we look at the end of verse 24, when we're getting more of the explanation, it says that he will destroy mighty men and the holy people. So the stars and the hosts are in reference to the Jews. And they cited references for that going back to Genesis 15, Genesis 17. Remember when God was talking to Abraham and he said that he would multiply his descendants like the sand of the sea or like the stars of the heavens. Then also if we look forward a little bit in Daniel 12:3, we see Jewish people, especially Jewish people with insight who seem to be blessed, referred to as stars. It says in 12:3 that those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of the heavens, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And there's also widespread agreement that the commander of the host is referring to God himself. And so this little horn that rises up after these four horns is going to set himself against the stars and the host of the stars. He's going to set himself against the Jewish people and against God, their commander.
So in verse 11, when it references prince of the host, that's God.
Yeah, that's what most people believe. I did hear one person suggest that perhaps that was talking about the high priest, the human high priest of the day. But for the most part, everybody else says, no, that's talking about the commander of the host or the prince of the host. That's talking about God himself and how this man was coming up after him. And so down in verse 14, we get this, is it 14? That is in 14?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm now in Daniel 9. Thank you. So yeah, in verse 14, it talks about the 2,300 evenings and mornings. And 2,300 days actually works out to be between 6 and 7 years, which happens to be how long Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted the Jews and the temple from 171 to 165 BC. And so we've talked about Antiochus before. When we were in Mark, we were talking about the Antichrist. A lot of people thought that Antiochus Epiphanes was perhaps the Antichrist. I think that he was just a picture of the Antichrist who is to come. And I want to read for us once again from 1 Maccabees. 1 Maccabees 1 verse 10 talks about this man Antiochus. It says, from them, again talking about the four generals that Alexander the Great divided his kingdom up to, from them came forth a sinful root, Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus. He had been a hostage in Rome. He began to reign in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. And so this Antiochus Epiphanes, again, who we had talked about before, he seems to be the fifth horn that we're talking about here from the goat. So the great first horn was Alexander the Great. Then four horns, his four generals popped up. He divided his land to them. And then out of one of them popped up Antiochus Epiphanes, who is just a terrible guy. And so as we, I'm going to actually jump forward in our text a little bit to verse 21. And as we read through this list, I want us to take note of everything that's said about this fifth horn, all right? So starting in verse 21 of Daniel chapter 8, it says, the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. I'm thankful for the clarity of that. That helps, right? And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, again, Alexander the Great. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings which has been told is true, but keep this vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. All right, so several things that we learn about this fifth horn from this passage. We see, first off, that he'll arise in the later period of the four kings, right? All this is right here in our text. I'm just putting it in a slide for us. He'll be insolent and skilled in intrigue. The ESV says bold, who understands riddles. Other versions say that he will be fierce looking, that he will understand dark sentences, describes him as rash and deceitful. So not a good guy, right? The text says that he will be powerful, but not his own power. So somebody else is giving him his power, right? He will destroy greatly. He will destroy both mighty men and holy people. We're told at the end there of verse 24. Mighty men and holy people he will destroy. He will prosper and perform his will. He will be deceitful, influential, proud, ruthless, and he will be against God. He will oppose the prince of princes, which, again, I take along with most other commentators to be referring to God himself. So not a good guy overall, right? Pretty evil, pretty wicked. And again, I'm convinced that this is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. Thoughts or questions at this point? I can. I will do that, right now.
Sorry.
Yes. No, you're good.
Yeah.
All right. One more thing that we have to point out before getting into specifics about Antiochus, going back to Maccabees, at the end of 25, that he will be broken without human agency. That is important. Just like we ended up last week talking about the little horn of chapter 7, the Antichrist to come, this man, this little horn of chapter 8, he will also be unsuccessful. He too will lose. That's important to note, right? That he's going to lose, not by human power, but by the strength of God's mighty power. God is one who's going to bring down this little horn again, who I see as Antiochus Epiphanes. And so now jumping back into 1 Maccabees, which that whole chapter really gives a great overview of Daniel chapter 8. If you're one who writes in your Bible, or if you have those ESV study notes, you might want to write 1 Maccabees chapter 1 next to Daniel chapter 8 because it helps provide a lot of information. So I want to read quite a bit from 1 Maccabees, in fact, starting with 1 Maccabees 1, verse 20. And I'll put it up on the screen so you can read along. It says that after subduing Egypt, so he went down to the south, just like the text says that he would do, and of course he went in the other direction, so try to conquer, just like the text says that he would do. After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. Now, remember, that's Daniel's focus now, from chapter 8 to chapter 12. He's focusing on Israel, and this little horn of chapter 8 is coming up against Israel now, as we're told here in 1 Maccabees. Picking up in verse 21 of 1 Maccabees 1, it says that he arrogantly entered the sanctuary and took the golden altar, the lampstand, and the light, and all of its utensils. He took also the table from the bread of the presence, the cup of drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crowns, the golden decorations on the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. This is the holy temple of God, right? That he has commanded be set up so that people can go in. This is where God's presence dwelt. And this evil, wicked man, Antiochus Epiphanes, just goes in and he takes all this stuff and desecrates it. Very evil, very wicked man. Verse 23, he took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures that he found. Taking them all, he went into his own land. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance. Israel mourned deeply in every community. So again, just a vile, wicked man, very arrogant, very boastful, right? Same things that we're seeing here in our text being described after the fact in 1 Maccabees. So Daniel 8 is prophecy, again, written in the 6th century BC, and Maccabees is written during the 400 years of silence. So this is written after the fact. Let's continue reading the history that's given after from 1 Maccabees chapter 1. Verse 29 says that 2 years later, the king sent to the cities of Judah a chief collector of tribute, and he came to Jerusalem with a large force. Deceitfully, he spoke peaceable words to them, and they believed him. But he suddenly fell upon the city, dealt it a severe blow, and destroyed many people of Israel. He plundered the city, burned it with fire, and tore down its house and its surrounding walls. Jumping to verse 37, it says, on every side of the sanctuary they shed innocent blood. They even defiled the sanctuary, that is, the temple. Because of them, the residents of Jerusalem fled. She became a dwelling of strangers. She became strange to her offspring, and her children forsook her. 39. Her sanctuary became desolate, like a desert. Her feasts were turned into mourning, her Sabbaths into a reproach, her honor into contempt. Her dishonor now grew as great as her glory. Her exaltation was turned into mourning. Verse 41. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and that all should give up their particular customs. He's trying to unify his kingdom, his empire, and telling the Jews, you guys can't be Jewish. You guys can't keep the Sabbath. You guys can't be circumcised. All these things he's wanting to get rid of. So all the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. 44. The king sent a letter to Jerusalem directing them to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priest, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals. Remember, the law specifically says you need to stay away from swine, anything that has split hooves and chews a cud, it's not for you, right? Verse 48, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. Again, that goes directly against what God commanded them.
They were to make themselves
abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. He added, and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. Now the last slide, jumping forward to verse 57. This is just wicked. It says, anyone found possessing the book of the covenant or anyone who adhered to the law was condemned to death by decree of the king. Verse 60, according to the decree, they put to death the woman who had their children circumcised and their families and those who circumcised them, and they hung the infants from their mother's neck. Just a wicked, grotesque man. Again, this is all written after the fact. Daniel 8 was written ahead of time, prophesying and predicting this. And you go back and again read from 23 to 26 and all those evil things that he's doing, that lines up so specifically with Antiochus to destroy the many while they are at ease. He intentionally tried to put them at ease so that he could destroy them, to oppose the prince of princes, to where does it talk about what he does with the law? It's in there somewhere. He's magnifying himself in his own heart, destroying to an extraordinary degree. He's just a complete wicked man. And I want to go back now. We skipped over a few verses. I want to go back to verse 15 and consider this matter of timing, because there are some interesting facts that we skipped over that we should address. So starting in verse 15 of chapter 8, it says, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. Some people will say that this is talking about one of the angels. Some will even speculate that perhaps this is Jesus who's speaking. In verse 16, it says, and I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So the understanding actually came from the mouth of Gabriel. This is the first mention of an angel by name in the Bible, by the way. And so verse 17 says that he came near where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and I fell on my face. That's the normal response we see when somebody sees an angel or God, right? They don't just write this story about their near-death experience like we see nowadays, but no, he fell on his face. And he said to me, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. So that's an interesting phrase, right? It pertains to the time of the end. Let's keep reading. Now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep and my face to the ground, and he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So we see three times these phrases in verse 17, the vision pertains to the time of the end, 19, the final period of indignation, and also appointed time of the end. And then later on in 26, it says that it pertains to many days in the future. And so trying to make sense of these phrases can be a bit difficult, and has proven a bit difficult for a lot of people, because remember, the third beast is the goat, right? And after the goat still comes the fourth and dreadful, terrifying beast. And so that's one reason why some equate the small horn of chapter 8 with the small horn of chapter 7, But again, I think this raises more questions than answers. One way to look at it is in relation to Daniel, to when Daniel was living, that it was in the end, according to his perspective, as he was writing again in 551 BC. And so some will take and break the period of indignation, which is speaking about God's wrath against Israel, into two periods. They'll say that the first half was the Israelites' oppression under Assyria and Babylon, and then the second half of the indignation would deal with their subjugation to Medo-Persia, to Greece, and to Rome. I prefer to see Antiochus as a type of the Antichrist to come, that he is prefiguring this even more dark, more blasphemous Satan-indwelt individual. There's, again, a lot of overlap in between the two individuals, Antiochus Epiphanes and the Antichrist who is to come, who we'll look more closely at in the next few weeks. I want to read to you this quote from John Walvoord. He says that it may be concluded that this difficult passage apparently goes beyond that which is historically fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, to foreshadow a future personage often identified as the world ruler of the end time. In many respects, this ruler carries on a persecution of Israel and desecration of the temple, similar to what was accomplished historically by Antiochus. This interpretation of the vision may be regarded as an illustration of double fulfillment of prophecy, or, using Antiochus as a type, the interpretation may go on to reveal additional facts which go beyond the type in describing the ultimate king who will oppose Israel in the last days. He indeed will be broken without hands at the time of the second advent of Jesus Christ. And so, again, specifically, I think it's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. I think that there are some shadows that are going forward, even to speaking about the Antichrist in the end. And now, wrapping up, looking again once at verse 27, which says, "Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. Then I got up again and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it." And so, again, if you're having a hard time wrapping your head around all this, that's okay. Because even Daniel, the interpreter of dreams, struggled to understand this after having it explained to him from the mouth of Gabriel. And so, if you're struggling with this, go home and read it again. Go home and read 1 Maccabees chapter 1. But don't lose sleep over it, because Daniel was having a hard time himself. And then, despite his confusion, he even got up and he went back to work. He worked for the king. He wasn't just going to get lost, right? He was going to keep working. In 1 and 2 Thessalonians, Paul has to remind the Thessalonians a few times, you guys need to work, because they're expecting the coming of Christ. They're waiting for the coming of Christ. And he tells them, no, you guys need to go home. You need to work. The dead in Christ will rise first. Christ is coming back. But he tells them, you need to excel still more. Keep working, because Christ is coming back. You don't just sit back and do nothing. We have a job to do, and we need to continue to work. So I'm going to throw up this slide again so you can take a look at that, and I'll close in prayer. God, we do thank you again for your word. Pray that you would give us understanding. We thank you that you are the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, that you are the stone that is cut without hands, that you will establish your kingdom, your empire forever, never to be destroyed again. God, we thank you that we are yours, that we know you, and that we can call you Father. God, we pray that you would help us to love you and to worship you more. Amen.